back around his desk and sat down. "You're working on Amy's eulogy?" I asked. I sat down opposite him, on a daybed he used when he napped or read. The room was slightly overheated. I slid my coat off. "Actually, Sunday sermon. I saw a connection and wanted to make some notes." He slid the papers on his desk around. He took off his glasses and poked fiercely at his closed eyes. Then he lifted his head and looked at me. "How was your day?" he asked. I shrugged. "Crazy. I did some really neat surgery, though."
"Ah, what?"
"A degloving on a cat. The owners wanted the legs saved, and I got to do it. Mary Ellen assisted." He looked blank. "It's when the skin is accidentally just peeled off." I gestured, peeling a glove back from the arm. "So much that there's no hope it'll ever regrow. Usually you just remove the leg when that happens, but these people didn't want that. So there's a kind of elaborate but wonderfully common-sense surgery you can do. I've only just read about it before, where you open the fur on the side of the cat and bend the leg back under it." I'd been excited, actually, while I did this, and Mary Ellen and I had talked eagerly to each other through the fussy procedure. "You make a kind of pocket, I guess you'd say, and then you stitch the fur back over the leg. In a little while, voila! The skin attaches itself to the leg, so you can open the pocket up, release the new furry extremity." My voice put quote marks around this phrase, and "stitch the flaps back together" sans the leg piece, which also gets stitched together. I sewed in the air for him. "It kind of pulls tight, but cats are stretchy guys." This one was.
"Stretchy guys," he said and laughed.
I felt a bloom of pride at pleasing him. "Daniel." Then he stopped and shook his head.
"What?"
I said after a moment. "Sometimes all that effort for an animal just seems nuts to me." I was suddenly defensive. "Love is love, Daniel, wherever it lands."
"I know, I know."
He seemed weary, old, suddenly, with his pale skin. His eyes reddened where he'd rubbed them. There was a nervous, steady pulse in one lid. "What's the program tonight?" I asked. "How can I help?"
"You've done enough. More than enough with the food and the bedrooms. Everyone's going to Amy's for dessert around 8:30, so we'll be out of your hair then, till bedtime anyway."
"I will be invisible at bedtime, in that I will be in bed."
"Not invisible to me, my darling."
"I hope not. But where is the rest of the family eating?"
"Well, the immediate family's at home with their parents, but I think quite a few are coming here. I told them we had plenty."
"We do."
"Some are headed for the inn," he shrugged. "Probably worried the minister wouldn't serve enough booze."
"They hadn't heard about the minister's wife, apparently." He smiled.
"Just as well. We need to have our secrets."
"So if everything's ready by, what, 6:30?
"Sounds good."
"I better get going then." He stood up and began to rearrange his desk.
"I'll be right over to help."
"You don't have to," I called back as I shut the door. Barn was a gloomy void after Daniel's warmly lighted study. I stood still for a moment, letting my eyes get used to the dark and smelling the barn's old deep must. Piano music drifted to me from the house, the player picking out a piece Cass had done in a recital once, a Mozart sonata. I went to the open doorway and looked across the shadowy yard. The windows were all lighted, and the house itself seemed flattened and two-dimensional in the twilight, as artificial as a stage set. Someone, it was an elderly man, caught my eye, moving haltingly through the living room. After a few seconds, he reappeared in the kitchen and stood bent over the food on the table, as though it were his house, as though we had never been. As though he and the person making music and the woman I saw upstairs now silhouetted for a moment in a bedroom window, were sufficient here. I was aware suddenly of feeling cancelled out, lost. I had a moment of what I suppose I must call grief, powerful sorrow, for myself and the girls and Daniel, for what had been our life in this place, and what was already, this is what I felt, passing, had always been passing. And then I forced myself to walk forward through the dark yard to the back door, putting a warm smile on my face, getting ready to be the minister's wife. It wasn't until Beatty mentioned the date at work the next morning that I realized it was Halloween. I'd done nothing to get ready. I skipped lunch with her so I could drive to the drugstore in another tiny mall closer to town and buy treats. The bags of small candy bars made expressly for this holiday were heaped in bins by the register. I bought two of them, 40 treats in all. Surely enough, I thought. But then, just as the heavy adolescent girl at the register had finished ringing me up, I reached back and grabbed another bag of 20. On Halloween, people drove in from the countryside and parked around the green to move from house to house in town. Out where they lived, everyone was too widely spaced. The checkout girl, Melanie, her plastic name tag told me, sighed in irritation and started her process again. At the end of the workday, I hurried home, but I could see as I pulled into the driveway that the little halting figures in groups of five or six were already making their way in the dark, some carrying flashlights. Their beams skittered and leapt wildly here and there. I'd probably missed quite a few. Quickly, I set up. A big bowl to dump the treats in. Four or five candles lighted in the front hall and on the stoop. We hadn't had a pumpkin in years, not since we found ourselves carving it alone in the kitchen, the bored girls having drifted off to TV or the telephone or homework. The bell rang almost right away, and I answered it, squealing in energetic fright at a small monster in a store-bought costume, the oldest of his troop and therefore the leader. I distributed candy to all of them. Two of them were tiny children, toddlers really, who'd been utterly silent as their older sibling brayed, "Trick or treat!" and who seemed not to know what to do now in front of this strange, noisy woman.
"Hold your bag up, dummy!"
Both of these little ones wore their masks tilted back on their heads for greater comfort, like beanies with faces. Their mothers were waiting on the walk, chatting with each other, pretty young women. They called out, "Thank you!" and "Happy Halloween!" as I was shutting the door. When they'd gone, I went to the closet off the living room and recovered my own mask, olive oil. I prized it for its expressionless innocence. It also made my life easier. I could just make olive oil's high squeaks as I distributed treats.
Ooh, ooh, mmm!
And be liberated from true conversation. Daniel came home around 6:30, and we had a quick supper, just sandwiches. We took turns rising to answer the bell several times. I asked him about the funeral. How had it gone?
"Harrowing," he said. Apparently, the oldest child, 7, cried loudly through the whole thing, sometimes even calling for her mother. I imagined it, Daniel speaking calmly in his rich, soothing voice, and the child answering, filling the air with her desperation. There could be no comfort for anyone else in the service, not in its solemn sorrow, or its shared rituals, or the old consoling words, with such scorching and entirely reasonable pain on display. Daniel seemed beaten, physically smaller, the sharp bones in his white face more pronounced than ever. After supper, he left for church to go over the Sunday service with the choir, who were at Friday night rehearsal. As the evening wore on, the numbers of kids dropped off and their ages went up. Now I had children 10 or 12, big children, unaccompanied by adults, in elaborate costumes they'd made themselves, swathed in bloody gauze, dolled up as a French tart, swaggering in wide lapels and Homburg as a 30s-era gangster. By 8:30, I had no candies left. Quickly, I gathered up and put in baggies all the cookies in the house left over from last night's company. When those were gone, I gave away all the apples and oranges and pears. Still, the tricksters came. A few sullen teenagers rang, costumes replaced by thuggish behavior. I should have realized that since Halloween fell on a Friday this year, it would become the evening's activity of choice for many more kids than usual. The last treats I gave out were an orange and two bananas to three boys who'd left their unmuffled car idling deafeningly at the curb while they came up the walk.
"Treat,"
they grunted in almost bored unison when I opened the door. There was a little silence when I handed the fruit over into their bare hands. They had no bags, of course. I was glad for my mask, for the distance it created between us.
"A banana," one of them said. "Is this some kind of fucking joke or something?"
"Trick!"
I squealed in Olive Oil's high-pitched voice and shut the door quickly. I blew the candles out after that, and there were no more visitors. When Daniel came home at 10, I tried to amuse him with this story, standing in the bathroom doorway as he brushed his teeth.
"Ooh,"
he said carefully, his mouth full of white foam. I had thought we might talk that night, but he was tired, and we went to bed almost right away without talking, without making love. I lay awake for a while, listening to his damp breathing, to the cars and the voices in the distance, to the occasional raucous shouting, which might have signaled a trick for the adults to clean up in the morning, eggs or soap, or a toilet paper wrapped around a tree. The next day, Saturday, when Beattie called me from the exam room to the phone, she whispered dramatically,
"It's that Jean Bennett again."
As I followed her down the back hall, I realized, by the rush of disappointment I was feeling, that I'd been hoping for Eli, to see him, to talk with him. That had been part of the arc of expectation I'd ridden through the long week. On Saturday, my other life would come back to me. Jean Bennett wanted to report on Arthur. Her voice sounded resigned. I heard in it, too, as I hadn't when she was in my office, that she was from the Midwest.
"No better at all," she was saying, "though he seems relaxed. In fact, he seems happy. Poor old guy."
"Well, I'm not surprised, honestly. I'm very sorry, though."
"Yes. Anyway, my husband, Eli, said to tell you he'd try to see you early next week, he thinks. He had to stay on in San Francisco for the weekend. But he'll come in Tuesday, most likely, to figure things out. I told him I didn't want to be in charge, nor did I want to be translating from you to him. He said he'd call to let you know exactly and to see what will work with you, of course."
"Of course," I said.
"And in the meantime, should I just keep on with the steroids and stuff?"
"Yes. Let's do the whole round, just in case. And if the Valium is keeping him mellow, I'd stick with that, too."
"Yes," she said.
I asked her if she needed a refill. She checked. She didn't. If Eli really could see me Tuesday. So we agreed to wait and said goodbye. After I hung up, I felt the weight of my disappointment. An empty feeling. I thought about it as I worked through the afternoon. What had I been imagining? Surely, when he came in, Eli and I would have talked mostly about Arthur, after all. But eventually, I thought, eventually, we would have come to Dana. Dana, and who we were then, and all that had happened. Surely that was so difficult as it was to imagine how we would begin. Remember the day after Dana was killed, when you got sick to your stomach because of all the blood? Remember the way the police went after Duncan? Remember how it felt to be the ones left alive? And now, that would all have to wait. I discovered how impatient I was. Is it too late to talk? Daniel had left the kitchen right after we cleaned up, gone back to his study for a while. When he returned, he'd gotten immediately into bed. Now he was staring blankly, an open book lying on the quilt that covered him. The light fell across his chest and over his hands on the sheet. He looked peculiarly like an invalid, which somehow irritated me. "I'm pretty tired," he said. "But I thought we would tonight. I'm sorry." He'd come late to dinner, too, after. I'd called over to the barn several times. He was preoccupied, he said, about his sermon. "It's just I've been alone with this all week." I was standing at the foot of the bed, trying not to sound impatient. "Alone with what?" He was frowning. "With Dana's death, with Eli's coming back." "Oh, that," he nodded. "Yes, yes, 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 that." "Oh, that." I tried to sound amused. "I'm sorry. It's just, it seems, in the context of all this," his hand lifted, "so remote." Now I nodded. I nodded and nodded, and then I left the room. I moved through the house, turning off lights. I came back to the bedroom doorway. He was reading. At any rate, he was holding the book upright. I said, "This is exactly what pisses me off about you, Daniel." He lowered his book. He took his glasses off and looked at me. I was leaned against the doorframe, arms folded. "I don't think I knew this, Joe, that there's something that pisses you off about me. As in, all the time, I assume." "Well, there is." He sighed. He looked away. He looked back at me. He was letting me know how tired he was. His voice, when it came, was patient and ministerial. "And is this the context in which you want to discuss it?" "No, I'm sorry. Of course, you're right." I hated that voice. I hated being talked to like that. "It isn't the context. You win." "Oh, now, come on, Joey." "No. No, you're right." I went to our bathroom. An odd, jury-rigged space off the hall where the front stairs had once been. I used the toilet. I brushed my teeth and washed my face. I came back into the bedroom and undressed, hanging my clothes on the hooks. Daniel was watching me now, the book set down. Finally, he said, "Why do you think you're so upset about Eli, about Dana?" I pulled on my t-shirt. I turned to him. I tried to keep my voice steady and reasonable. "Daniel, why not? It's this horrible, violent thing in my past that is part of who I am and of how I got to be who I am, and I live with it all the time in some faraway sense, and now it's here, it's in my life again." My voice had risen. There was a short silence, and then he said, "I didn't know either that you lived with it all the time." His tone weighted the words, and I understood that he thought I was being melodramatic. "Oh, Daniel, you know what I mean." "I don't, I'm afraid." "I'm afraid," I mocked. His skin seemed to tighten. "Let's talk about this tomorrow," he said, "when we're not so tired." "I'm not tired." "Right," he said, and he turned out his light. "Good night." Being plunged into darkness at his whim, I thought, felt like being slapped. I had to force myself to breathe evenly. I shut the bedroom door behind me. I paced the house frantically, Bailey and Allie behind me. Tears seemed to jolt from my eyes. In the kitchen, everything was tidy and still in the green glow of the appliance's digital clocks. Someone coming in here would think this was a lovingly ordered household, a place of peace and concord. "I hate this," I thought. "I hate my life." I stood with my hands on an old bowl left to dry on the kitchen sink. Its shape and the raised ceramic grapes on its side were utterly familiar under my fingers. "I could smash this. I would wreck things." Bailey moaned in worry behind me. Why hadn't I gone to bed? Why was I roaming the dark house? Why wasn't I moving now? Why was I weeping? I went to the kitchen door and opened it. The rain that had threatened and spit off and on through the day had started in earnest now. It made a steady rustling noise on the dry leaves that had fallen all week in the yard. The cool air blew wet through the screen onto my face, onto my bare arms and legs. I stood there until I was shivering, until finally I wanted to dry my tears and find the warmth of my bed. Daniel was gone when I woke. The steady sound of the rain had kept me falling in and out of sleep until nearly 10. In the bathroom mirror, my eyes were swollen from crying. I ran the cold water until it numbed my fingers, and then I filled the bowl. I held my hair back and bent over, pushing my face in. I opened my eyes wide and saw the clear blue white of the basin through the water. I stayed there until my cheekbones felt like cracking from the cold. My dripping face, when I stood up, was a brilliant, deep pink. I thought, I'll go to church. Religion had not been a part of my upbringing, although, since it was a kind of social requirement, as a little girl I went semi-regularly to church with my mother. But my father, man of science as he saw himself, thought faith was a childish comfort for the weak, and this is what I came to feel too, probably mostly in order to be more grown up, more like him. When I fell in love with Daniel then, I wasn't sure what my feelings would be about his work or about my own religious impulses. I was very moved on the rare occasions when I heard him preach. He was only a part-time and very assistant pastor in those days. I think that early on, I mistook this feeling in myself for incipient faith and hoped it would grow, that Daniel and I would have this in common. But as I learned to separate my pride in and love for him from what I did or didn't feel about the church, I saw that this wasn't going to happen, and what's more, my work and then the girls kept me from any kind of regular attendance. By the time he got his first church, Daniel and I understood enough about each other to make it clear to the search committee that they could not expect to be getting a traditional minister's wife in me. That had remained our pattern in the other two churches he'd taken. I did what I could to support him. I made our home a part of his ministry, but I attended church only sporadically, and I did not perform any role in its life. Fortunately, it turned out that this was not as problematic as it has seemed at one time it might be. More and more, as wives of ministers worked, and as ministers themselves were women with working husbands, the church used assistant pastors and lay people to perform these functions anyway. I know my not attending church was noted. At any rate, my occasional appearances were the trigger for hearty chuckles and jokes. Well, I guess this is going to be one hell of a sermon. But I don't think many people took offense at my removal from the church's life. They were used to it by now. Today, I felt my attendance would be a gesture of conciliation after our minor ugliness to each other the night before. A way of apologizing, of merging our lives again. I suppose also I was seeking to see Daniel at his best, as a means of kindling my admiration for him, of letting what was finest in him touch me, stir me, call up all my love. The rain was steady as I drove over. A mist still sat in the low parts of the fields, where the grass was turning yellow-brown. Ahead of me, most of the way, was a car that carried four older women wearing hats. But they drove on when I turned off at the green where Daniel's church was. Another town, another church for them. I hadn't brought an umbrella, so after I'd parked, I half walked, half ran through the rain, trying to favor my good hip. The church doors stood open, and I stopped in the narthex to take my coat off and shake it out. I entered the nave and moved to a pew about two-thirds of the way down, just at the edge of the fuller rows. I slid in and sat down. I bent my head and pretended to pray so I wouldn't have to meet anyone's eye and nod or smile. I could hear the little wave of interest and curiosity move across the few pews nearest me. Hear it as the lightest hiss of whispered information, as a rustle of fabric on skin when the bodies turn slightly to take me in. I looked down at my hands, clasped in my lap. How bony they'd become, and listened to the depressive meandering of the organ. The rain was a drummin' on the high slope roof, a moving beaded silver on the clear glass windows. The organ focused in briefly on a melody and then stopped. Daniel rose from his invisible seat behind the pulpit. A slender man made somehow massive by the full black robe. He said, "Let us pray." And then the words, "Almighty God." I gave myself over to it again, to the world whose beautiful ancient rituals he believed in and I sometimes yearned for. I rose, I sat, I opened my hymnal with the others. I recited the prayers and confessions, just another member of the congregation. There was a moment, though, when I knew Daniel recognized me, when he realized I was there. He made no motion, gave no sign, but there was a kind of sharpening of his attention, which I felt connecting us. After that, he could look away, or he could look directly at me, but it didn't matter. I felt that every gesture and word was meant for me, without excluding any of the others. I was glad I'd worn the dress I had, a draped gray silk with a white collar, which he loved. When Daniel stood for the sermon, he surveyed the room and then he smiled. "A belated happy Halloween," he said. There was that polite titter which greets anything even approaching humor from the minister. He often started this way, talking casually, today telling an anecdote about me. "At our house," he said, "we ran out of treats." His eyes had swung to me, and they rested there as he continued. The tough guys were there, and the bananas, not the obscenity, though, and his gentle smile apologized to me for the censorship. After this information, he talked about the history of Halloween, the conflation of pagan rites with the celebration of All Saints' Day, which this Sunday was, he pointed out. He defined it, talked about its traditions. The drumming of the rain on the roof intensified and slowed as he spoke. He read again parts of the scripture lessons, a passage from the Old Testament about Israel living in safety in a land of grain and wine, where the heavens drop down dew. He read the passage he'd selected from Revelation, pointing out the startling specificity of the promises, the beauty and safety of the 12-gated city, coming at last to the magical lines I looked up much later. "And the 12 gates are 12 pearls. Each of the gates is a single pearl. And the street of the city is pure gold, transparent as glass. Its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there." He quoted next from hymns, from popular culture, pointing out the various images of heaven, of eternal life that surround us daily. He talked about the way we construct our ideas of an afterlife from all these promises, the way we borrow this language to console ourselves and others when someone dies, when we lose our private saints, our household saints. "And yet," he said and paused, "and yet, it seems these images, this language, have lost their power to console." And he called up for the congregation his grandmother, a time she took him in her confidence to tell him that though she'd once believed she would meet her husband and all her dear departed friends after death, that they would all be in heaven together, she no longer did so. She no longer even knew, she said to him, where they'd gone. I'd met his grandmother a few times in her great old age, a tall, skinny woman with a low-slung bosom, dress for company whenever we visited in the same ancient, shiny navy blue dress. She had let Cassie rest on her lap while she rocked and talked to us one of those times, and after Cass climbed down and toddled off, she leaned forward conspiratorially and said,
"That one is full of the devil."
And I'd felt an unfamiliar clutch of fear, as if a fairy tale witch had cast a spell on my child. "If my grandmother," Daniel was saying now, "so well-schooled in the Bible, so instinctive a believer, so surrounded by old-fashioned faith, came to question these promises, who among us in this more secular world can believe any more in such consolations?" He shook his head. "No, most of us, if we believe the Bible at all about eternal life, believe it purely as metaphor. It must be something like a land of milk and honey. It is like a 12-gated city. It will be as though we experienced shade and light all at once, and the absence of night and hunger and thirst and pain. But even this has no power for most people. The little child," he said, "whose parent dies cannot conceive an afterlife, even through metaphors. And why should such a vision console someone whose feeling is, 'I want my mommy. Bring me back my mommy.' Whose question is, 'Where is she now?' Most of us are like that child in the face of the death of someone we love," he said, "inconsolable, yearning, in a pain that feels permanent, that feels it will always be part of who we are. But pain may be a gift to us, and to that child. Remember, after all, that pain is one of the ways we register in memory the things that vanish, that are taken away. We fix them in our minds forever by yearning, by pain, by crying out. Pain. The pain that seems unbearable at the time is memory's first imprinting step, the cornerstone of the temple we erect inside us in memory of the dead. Pain is part of memory, and memory is a God-given gift." His speech had become more rhythmic along the way, something the girls used to tease him about. With their noses for hypocrisy, for falsehood, they didn't like him to be other than their Daniel. Bogus, they called any way of talking not his own. And from this, they developed a dismissive name for any preacher who seemed to specialize in a false tone in the pulpit. A bogue. Said with flippant contempt, "What a bogue he was." But I felt a breathlessness hearing it now, knowing he was drawing toward his point. He raised his arm and the sleeve fell darkly away. "We pity the child who cries out," he intoned. "Perhaps we should pity more the younger child who doesn't, who cannot know his loss, who won't remember." He turned. The light glinted on his glasses. "For there will come a time when the lucky child who felt enough to weep then will at last be able to smile and say, 'Remember when Mommy read me those stories? Remember when she danced? Remember when she made my costume?' When the friend who thought she would never recover from grief, when the husband or wife who thought his own life was over will cease to cry, will be able to take pleasure in saying, 'Remember how she used to lean her head back when she laughed? Remember how he loved to garden out there way past the last frost? Remember when she cut all her hair off and was so sorry?'" Dana, I was thinking, remembering it now, the hair heaped on the box, her face in the mirror. "And the funny things. Remember how he loved those knock-knock jokes and how bad he was at telling them?" The congregation laughed lightly, as though they had known this person and were remembering. "Remember, The time she reached for the pitcher and poured orange juice into her coffee and drank it anyway. More titters. I laughed too, though I was still thinking of Dana, of the beauty revealed in the face surrounded by the lopped-off hair. Daniel paused. A long pause. His voice, when he spoke again, was soft, nearly a whisper. And feel the pleasure in having her there again, in bringing him back to life for those moments. A new life. Truly, a life after death. His face seemed to tighten. Because if metaphor is one of the ways we have left to approach God, to begin to understand faith, memory itself is a living metaphor for the eternal life. He paused, then slowly said, "Loss brings pain, yes, but pain triggers memory. And memory is a kind of new birth within each of us. And it is that new birth after long pain, that resurrection in memory, that to our surprise, perhaps, comforts us. It comforts us, and that comfort, and even joy, the comfort that rises within each of us by the grace of God, that comfort teaches us something here on earth about eternal life. It makes us all feel something we can believe in about its promise." He waited a moment, looking out over the heads of his congregation, looking, I felt, into me, and then he bent his head and read. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away.'" He lifted his head. "Remember it," he said. "In this world, God gives us pain, but he gives us memory too, to change that pain to laughter, to joy, to bring the dead back into our lives, to comfort us, to make us understand by this living metaphor his tender power." He rested his hands on the edge of the pulpit. "To show us how, in that new world, God himself will wipe away all tears." There was a long silence, and then he said gently, "Happy Halloween." He raised his hand. "Happy All Saints' Day." And as he disappeared from my sightline, the organ pealed out the opening bars for the last hymn, and we all stood and busied ourselves looking it up. We sat for the benediction. I kept my head bowed as Daniel walked past me down the aisle, though I could have reached out and touched his robe, though I felt the air around me stir with his passage. He stood in the narthex out of the rain to greet the parishioners. I shuffled slowly up the aisle with the others, chatting politely when I needed to. Those in a hurry vanished out the side aisles, but most people seemed to want the company of these last minutes as a congregation. The air cooled and dampened as I moved back. The church doors were open to the dark day and the rain, which had picked up again, roared dully behind all the other noises. We tightened our coats, buttoned them. There was a smell of wet on the earth, on the fallen leaves. It was wonderfully fresh after the closeness of the church. As I drew nearer, Daniel's face was in shadow, turned to greet the next churchgoer and the next, the grey light falling from behind him. He was shaking each hand, commenting, receiving comment. He held on to people. He touched their shoulders. He bent to hear the fragile, elderly voice, the thin, childish one. In front of me was an old couple, and Daniel took his time with them, seeming not to be aware of me waiting behind them. Yet I felt the tension in his not looking, in his not acknowledging my presence. The old man had much to say about the afterlife, perhaps triggered by the sermon, but largely irrelevant to it. He was talking loudly now of his Sunday school teacher.
"She always used to say,"
and here he lifted his gnarled finger,
"shall we gather by the river?"
Dramatic pause.
"Now, can you imagine how confusing that was to a small boy afraid of crocodiles?"
He laughed a loud, thoroughly practiced laugh. And Daniel laughed too. I had been feeling an adolescent's impatience, a tickling, pleasurable irritation as I waited, so that when Daniel finally turned his pale eyes to me, I could have cried out. His hand was shockingly warm to my touch in the chill air. He pulled me to him quickly, kissed my cheek. The cool smoothness of his face, the way he smelled, the sense of his taut body under the robe, made me breathless, and I couldn't prevent a quick burst of giddy laughter. I stepped back. He still held my hand, and I felt myself flushing.
"Thank you for a wonderful sermon," I said.
"You, above all others, are welcome."
His face was grave and smiling at once. Then he turned away, as he needed to, and I moved on, out into the rain. But as I sprinted awkwardly down the street for the car, I felt such a wild, reckless joy and excitement that I wanted to yell, to dance under the pelting rain. "Daniel!" I wanted to shout. I wanted to tell the others, running too, scattering to their cars around the green. "Daniel! My husband!"
Chapter 7
"Mayhew?" I called. I wouldn't have recognized the man who came around the corner from the waiting room, but as he moved toward me down the hallway, I adjusted my memory. Flesh had weighted the tall, big-boned frame. He'd gotten solid and wider. He'd become somehow prosperous-looking. His walk was a little shambling as he came toward me with the dog in his arms. Ah, he had a slight paunch, and he was completely gray. His hair was shorn tidily, but still wavy. His face, too, had thickened, I saw, as he drew near, smiling at me. A handsome, jowly, middle-aged man.
"Stead," he answered mockingly as he entered, the light falling into the hall from the exam room. I laughed. "Not now. Not ever, actually, as you may remember."
We stood a moment looking at each other, I just in the room, he just outside it. Then he said,
"Here's Arthur. Let me..."
He moved past me to the examining table.
"Let me get him down."
And with a tenderness that seemed incongruous in such a large man, he lowered Arthur onto the table, settling him with a few caressing strokes. Then he turned to me and extended his hand. His face was heavily lined. I saw lines of intelligence and worry. The flesh around his eyes was pouched and deeply cross-hatched. He was gripping my hand now and moving it with both of his.
"Just such a surprise, and of course a pleasure."
He released me.
"Is it Dr. Becker now? I don't know what to call you."
His eyes probed me, and I thought abruptly of the visual adjustments he was making, too.
"No, Joey, not Dr. Becker," I said. "Please."
His hands had been warm and dry.
"And certainly not Lish," he said.
"No, but you knew that even way back then."
"Yes. I vaguely remember some ceremonial unveiling of the true you. Though I must say, I've thought of you as Lycia all these years."
I noticed now that there was an ironic quality to the care, the precision with which he spoke, mocking or self-mocking. I moved around to what I thought of as my side of the table. I felt I needed to speak, perhaps mostly to put myself at ease.
"I have to say, Eli, It was a real shock when your wife, when Jean said your name, and we figured out it must be you. But I'm delighted. I guess I'm delighted. I smiled at him, and he smiled back, his eyes almost disappearing into the flesh around them. I was reeling for a few days with all those difficult memories, but I guess I found, I shrugged, well, I don't know, a fondness for myself for those times. What I've remembered mostly is how young and sweet we all were, so I've actually looked forward to this.
Sweet, eh?
Oh, yes, I said. You don't think so?
He shook his head. In any case, I haven't been sure what to feel.
And then he smiled again, and I realized that his smile hadn't changed. There was still something surprising in the way it opened his serious face, something youthful in it. His eyes shifted down. He gestured at the scrubs I wore, at the white jacket.
I must say, it's extraordinary to see you in the costume of science.
Oh,
it's not worth wearing real clothes at this job, I said. I'm always startled that a few vets do. Well, no, what I meant was, thinking of the past, one of the things I remember most clearly was that schism in the house, the group house, don't you? That anti-science sentiment? The contempt in which everyone held my kind of work? At least, I felt it was so, and I even had it myself. I was embarrassed, more than a bit embarrassed about my own work.
Were you?
I guess I remember that a little. Of course I did. We had all thought of Eli as dull, as less remarkable than we were, because he dealt with facts. We glorious others live for art, literature, music, the imagination, what might be. He was stuck, poor Eli, with what was.
I was ashamed, in fact, he shook his head.
The 60s, what a rotten decade.
Well, often this doesn't feel much like science, actually. In fact, sometimes it seems like so much hocus-pocus. I mean, there are a few things we can cure, but a lot of it is still sort of primitive. A thought occurred to me. I read something by Chekhov once about what it felt like to be a doctor in the 19th century, how little one could actually do about so many things. I lifted my hands, as with our friend here.
So I understand, Eli said. He reached over and patted Arthur. Do you want to talk about the options? I asked.
The dog had been lying still on the table, seemingly relaxed, watching the discussion move from one of us to the other. Whenever Eli touched him, he lifted his muzzle and his watery gaze in trusting greeting.
Oh, it's you.
Jean said there was a surgical possibility, Eli said. I shook my head. No, I said. No, in fact, there really isn't here. I probably mentioned it to her because sometimes with these back crises, if we can get to them soon enough, there is a chance with surgery. But I'm afraid that by the time we knew something was seriously wrong with Arthur, the damage had been done.
He nodded. She must have spoken of this, too. She must have blamed herself.
I'm certain, and I rarely say this, but I am certain in this case, that there'd be no point.
I explained to Eli what I thought had happened to Arthur, what I thought the choices and options actually were. We were standing on opposite sides of the examination table while I talked with the dog between us. Eli's questions to me were quick, probing, always apt. His face was mobile in its responsiveness to whatever I said. His forehead deeply corrugated in a frown, his lips tightening, his thick eyebrows moving up and down to register my points. I thought abruptly of the careful mask that other Eli had worn, the cautious way he carried himself. This Eli was alive, and the energy in his face was testimony to that. Even the lines, evidence of a lived life. He rested his hands on Arthur from time to time, as I did. Our hands touched once, and I moved mine away quickly.
So, what you're really recommending is euthanasia, he said finally.
He was leaning against the wall, his arms crossed, his face was grave. I had sat down on my stool by now to rest my hip. I shook my head. No. No, not at all.
Then why do I hear that? He asked. It wasn't a hostile question.
Because I did say it's incredibly time-consuming and overwhelming to most people. But I have clients who manage it, too, to be exact. Sometimes we have one of the dogs here for boarding, Sam. Sam the Dachshund. And he's a happy guy. But he drags his hindquarters around, and we have to express his bladder for him, just as you've been doing with Arthur, all that kind of thing. There's a lot of clean-up, a lot of work. An image occurred to me. Maybe you've seen this photo. It's kind of a famous photo by Duono. It shows a log in a cart on the street in Paris. They make carts for these dogs, the smaller ones, I explained. You strap them in their hind legs. The picture is quite lovely, I think, quite charming. I had been delighted when I discovered it, leafing through a collection of Guano's work in a bookstore in Boston. Two women talk animatedly in a doorway, and the dog sits in profile on the sidewalk in front of them, sleek, alert, poised to go, with his hindquarters slung easily over his tiny cart, a cart whose pretty wheels seem a winsome and somehow logical extension of his body. But Eli's face had tightened in disgust. No, I haven't seen it. I pointed at him, at his face. That, my friend, is why you hear this as a recommendation for euthanasia. You don't like any part of the idea. He stared a moment, considering it, his jaw working slightly. I'm afraid this is true, he said at last. Well, it's true for a lot of people. It's how they feel about damaged animals, and it's perfectly reasonable, it seems to me, when there's so much work involved for the owner. And I think, I mean, from what I understand, it sounds as though you and your wife, you and Jean, are pretty much at your limit with work and travel and the move, and it occurred to me suddenly, do you have kids too? No. Then he smiled. Just Arthur here. Do you? He asked after a second or two. I do, three. But they're all more or less grown and gone at this point. Three girls, excuse me, women, I said. Separately, they paraded through my mind. Hello, hello, hello. And you're still married?
Yes, I said.
Yes, he echoed. He shook his head. I would have bet money you were going to end up divorced. I had a moment of confusion, and then I realized he was talking of my past, of the marriage I was running from when he knew me. Oh, that marriage did end, sorry, I smiled. I always feel that one doesn't even count. I laughed quickly, a funny false noise that vaguely embarrassed me. No, it was over right then, actually. All part of the counter-life, or that dream we were all dreaming, or whatever it was. But I've been married to Daniel, to the girl's father, for 25 years or so now. Ah, he said. And then we both fell silent, looking at Arthur. It's a very hard decision to make, I said gently. The standard party line. I actually have a brochure I can give you. Is to weigh certain factors against each other. But in the end, I think it probably rests more with what your feeling about animals is, whole versus not whole, and so forth, and how you see yourself or humans generally in relation to them. Big philosophical issues that translate into visceral, gut-level responses. His face had collapsed and become blank as he studied Arthur. And then, unfortunately, have to get weighed against the kind of affection you feel for the dog. Yes, he said. His hands moved to Arthur again. The dog made a loving grumble of response. And it's hardest of all, I think, with this kind of injury. I gestured at Arthur's muzzle. When they're not in pain and they're so normal in the front. Yes, he said softly. We stood there for a moment, both looking at Arthur. He blinked and lowered his head to his paws, watching us, as though he understood we were talking about him. You certainly don't need to decide anything now, I said, or on any kind of schedule. He cleared his throat. And the awful thing is, I have decided. I'm just not ready to act on it.
Well, that's fine, too. Take him home again. Get used to the idea. Or as used to it as you can, and just call me whenever you're ready. We can keep him on the Valium to make his life easier.
Another long silence fell.
Then he looked at me keenly.
Do you do a lot of these?
Euthanasias?
Yes.
Not enough to ever find it easy.
Would you do it to a dog of yours in a similar situation? Do you have a dog?
I have three.
He smiled. One for each daughter,
as it turned out. And the answer is I don't know what I'd do. I think I might find it easier than you to have an incapacitated dog around just because of my work. But I can also think of situations my dogs could be in where I'd have no hesitation, none, about the euthanasia. I had actually tried 5 or 6 years earlier to euthanize one of our own dogs myself, Lou. He was 18, incontinent, and so arthritic that he could barely move. He snapped when you tried to help him. It hurt so much. We had all adored him for his beauty and strength and speed when young, for his gentleness, particularly with the girls when they were little, and for his great heart. Whenever anyone in the household wept, he came and sat leaned against her, whimpering gently in sympathy. When I picked up the pink syringe of euthanasia, I started to cry so hard that I couldn't see through my tears to find a vein, and Mary Ellen had to take over. But even that's beside the point, I said now. It's your judgment and your feelings that matter.
I understand that, of course. I just wondered. Another silent moment passed. I looked quickly at my watch. Eli saw me. He bent at once over Arthur and lifted him, just as I stepped toward him and touched his arm. I'm sorry. I don't want to rush you.
No. No, this is really between me and Arthur now. We don't need to take any more of your time. We shouldn't.
I came around behind him to open the door, and when he turned to me, our faces were suddenly very close. I could smell him, an expensive, lathery odor.
I'll call you next week, then, he said.
He smiled, a quick, sad smile.
That terrible line. True, in this case.
I'd step back. I'm sorry it has to be. He sobered.
And the Valium?
I'll meet you up front with it. How much do you want? A week's worth? His mouth tightened.
At the most, he said.
As he was standing in the front doorway to leave a few minutes later, he turned to me behind the counter and said,
At some point, Joe, it'd be nice to talk about life. Life beyond dogs.
Oh, is there such a thing? I asked.
I could feel Beatty's gaze shift sharply over to me from her computer. He smiled again, and then he was gone.
Who was that big fat man? Beatty asked later. You know, Mayhew, the one who belongs to Arthur?
Beatty, he wasn't fat.
We were moving around each other in the hallway office, she printing out billing records, I checking supplies.
You know him from somewhere?
I do, actually. My deep, dark past, why? What makes you ask?
Your voice was different, is all.
I thought about this, wondering if it was true.
Well, I thought he was fat,
Beatty said after a few moments. She wasn't looking at me. The printer ground away.
But I like him thin. Daniel, now. That's my type.
You can't have him, Beatty. Her laugh shrilled and she walked off, trailing computer paper.
Fall seemed to deepen as the week went by. It was colder, very cold at night, and often in the morning a frost clung to the golden grass. The brightest leaves, the cerise and pale yellow of the maples, were gone by now, and just the golden yellow of birches and the deep red-brown of oaks remained. The vistas had opened up slowly as the leaves fell,
and blew into bright piles that collected against the fence lines and shrubs that pooled at the edges of the roads. Now you could take in the whole town at once. You could see past the white houses to the distant mountains beyond. All week, I waited for Eli to call or appear. I thought of him often, of him and Arthur. But he didn't come in, and he didn't telephone. Over the weekend, we had a reprieve suddenly. 3 Indian summer days, golden, warm. Daniel and I decided to take our Monday afternoon to put the storm windows in and clean them. We did this on opposite sides of the glass, so we could talk as we went along, and also to point out streaks to each other. The air was dry and cool as it drifted over me in the house, but Daniel was working outside in the sun. First, he pulled off his sweatshirt, then the plaid flannel long-sleeved shirt under that. In his T-shirt and jeans, he looked lean and tough, like the bad boys I wasn't allowed to date in high school. I could see the muscles working in his arms, the cording tendons. He caught me watching him as he rubbed the glass between us with his cloth, watching and not working. He stopped, too.
"What?"
he said loudly. I shook my head and grinned. I leaned forward and put my lips on the cool glass, pressed them. When I pulled back, I yelled,
"You're cute."
He smiled and then raised his hand and tapped the glass by the mark of my lips.
"Streak,"
he announced. I made a face and wiped it away. Ever since the Sunday I'd gone to church and then waited in bed for Daniel to come home, washed, perfumed, the space heater faintly humming on high so he could be naked in comfort, I'd been eager for him. Not all the time, to be sure, because our lives were so disparate and busy. But there it was. The 3 times we had made love since had been with a newness, a wily attentiveness to each other that surprised me. One of these times, we'd actually tried it standing up in the kitchen with me in my striped bathrobe, backed up against the wall. But Daniel had abruptly cried, "Ah, no, no." When we stopped, he said, "That was my back yelling, not me." So we'd shut the dogs in the kitchen and done it on the living room couch, with their dolorous halloos, our distracting music. And one night, when we were both tired, we spent a while laughing and arguing desultorily about who should do the work. "No, you get on me." Until finally, I reached down between my legs and began lazily to touch myself. Daniel slid back to watch me. After a minute, he began to stroke himself too, and we watched each other for a while, our breathing getting more and more ragged, until we both shut our eyes and arched away from each other, crying out over and over in a nicely timed duet. It was all fun, but to me, it felt a little abstract, too. A little the way I'd felt during those impulsive, driven months of hungry activity on and off through veterinary school. It made me wonder if there wasn't something about seeing Eli again, about the return of my past into my present life that was fueling my appetite. Why does hunger come when it comes? Or need? And does it matter? Shouldn't we just be happy to have it arrive again from time to time? I didn't know, but I thought of it now as I watched Daniel at work through the glass. Cass had called 2 nights before this. Her slow circle around the country was closing, bringing her back to us. She was in Pennsylvania now. She thought she'd be home for about a week at Thanksgiving, though she couldn't say for sure what day she'd arrive. Daniel and I talked about it during the intervals when I was lifting the panes from inside to set them in place or sliding them up, the intervals of only air between us. I wanted to get all the girls home for the holiday. Daniel thought that was probably a mistake, that Cass might want us to herself, and that in any case, all 3 of them together often led to trouble. "If she wants to see Nora, she can easily go to New York," he said. He was perched up on the extension ladder. Behind him, the sky opened up over the hills, and the dark road wound left and disappeared into pine woods. "But wouldn't you like to have us all together again? It won't happen that often in our lives as they get older and move away." "I don't know," he said. I hoisted the glass up between us. and we lifted our plastic bottles and sprayed at each other. As we both began to wipe at the mist, as Daniel's composed face began to come clear, frowning in private concentration at his task, I thought of Eli Mayhew suddenly, that open, expansive quality to the way he looked now. People could change, I thought, and I wondered for an idle moment if Eli had found that true of me, and if so, how? In the end, Daniel agreed to my issuing a Thanksgiving invitation to all the girls. That night, I called Nora.
How long will she be there?
It's not clear, Natch.
Natch is right, she sighed.
Damn, I have this project due. I wasn't even going to have Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we were just going to have a minimal thing ourselves, just with Sadie, because Daddy has that big church meal the Sunday before.
Christ, she said.
I could imagine her gnawing her lower lip, a habit she didn't share with Cassie.
Well, I suppose I can work it out.
I was silent for a moment, feeling guilty, but then irritated at having to feel that way.
Look, Nora, I finally said, it's not written in stone. I said nothing to Cass about it. It was just an idea I had.
No, I'll come. Her voice was resigned.
But now I feel guilty. I'm not putting pressure on you. Honest, I'm not.
Mom, come on. I really do want to see her. I haven't for more than a year, and she is my sister. My twin, for God's sake.
After a beat, I said, Brian's welcome too, you know.
She made a slight snorting noise.
I'll spare him, I think.